morning the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now. Hush, the babies are sleeping. The farmers, the fishers, the tradesmen and pensioners, cobbler, schoolteacher, postman and publican, the undertaker and the fancy woman, drunkard, dressmaker, preacher, policeman, the web-foot cockle women and the tidy wives. Young girls lie bedded soft or glide in their dreams with rings and trousseau, bridesmaided by glowworms down the aisles of the organ-playing wood. The boys are dreaming wicked, or of the bucking ranches of the night and the jolly Rogered Sea, and the anthracite statues of the horses sleep in the fields, and the cows in the byres, and the dogs in the wet-nosed yards, and the cats nap in the slant corners, or lope sly, streaking and needling on the one cloud of the roofs. You can hear the dew falling, and the hushed town breathing. Only your eyes are unclosed to see the black, unfolded town fast and slow asleep. And you alone can hear the invisible starfall, the darkest before dawn minutely dew-gray stir of the black, dab-filled sea, where the Arethusa, the Curlew, and the Skylark, Zanzibar, Rhiannon, the Rover, the Cormorant, and the Star of Wales tilt and rise. Listen, it is night moving in the streets, the processional salt slow musical wind in Coronation Street and Cockle Row. It is the grass growing on Llareggub Hill, dewfall, starfall, the sleep of birds in Milkwood. Listen, it is night in the chill, squat chapel, hemming in bonnet and brooch and bombazine black, butterfly choker and bootlace bow, coughing like nanny goats, sucking mintos, 40 winking hallelujah. Night in the four ale, quiet as a domino, in Ocky Milkman's lofts like a mouse with gloves, in Dye Bread's bakery, flying like black flour. It is tonight in Donkey Street, trotting silent with seaweed on its hooves, along the cockled cobbles, past curtained fern pot, text and trinket, harmonium, holy dresser, watercolours done by hand, china dog and rosy tin tea caddy. It is night, neddying among the snuggeries of babies. Look, it is night, dumbly, royally winding through the coronation cherry trees, going through the graveyard of Bethesda with winds gloved and folded and dew-doffed, tumbling by the sailor's arms. Time passes. Listen. Time passes. Come closer now. Only you can hear the houses sleeping in the streets in the slow, deep, salt and silent black bandaged night. Only you can see in the blinded bedrooms the combs and petticoats over the chairs, the jugs and basins, the glasses of teeth, thou shalt not on the wall, and the yellowing dicky bird watching pictures of the dead. Only you can hear and see behind the eyes of the sleepers the movements and countries and mazes and colors and dismays and rainbows and tunes and wishes and flight and fall and despairs and big seas of their dreams. From where you are, you can hear their dreams.
Why wait for heaven? Those who seek the light are merely covering their eyes. The light is in them now. Enlightenment is but a recognition, not a change at all. Light is not of this world. Yet you who bear the light in you are alien here as well. The light came with you from your native home and stayed with you because it is your own. It is the only thing you bring with you from him who is your source. It shines in you because it lights your home and leads you back to where it came from, and you are at home. This light cannot be lost. Why wait to find it in the future, or believe it has been lost already, or was never there? It can so easily be looked upon, that arguments which prove it is not there become ridiculous. Who can deny the presence of what he beholds in him? It is not difficult to look within, for there all vision starts. There is no sight, be it of dreams or from a truer source, that is not but the shadow of the seen through inward vision. There perception starts, and there it ends. It has no source but this. The peace of God is shining in you now, and from your heart extends around the world. It pauses to caress each living thing, and leaves a blessing with it that remains forever and ever. What it gives must be eternal. It removes all thoughts of the ephemeral and valueless. It brings renewal to all tired hearts, and lights all vision as it passes by. All of its gifts are given everyone, and everyone unites in giving thanks to you who give and you who have received. The shining in your mind reminds the world of what it has forgotten, and the world restores the memory to you as well. From your salvation radiates with gifts beyond all measure, given and returned. To you, the giver of the gift, does God himself give thanks, and in his blessing does the light in you shine brighter, adding to the gifts you have to offer the world. The peace of God is shining in me now. Let all things shine upon me in that peace, and let me bless them with the light that is in me. Was Yagat Bhatia by Vidya Rao. I'd like to continue where I left off last time from A Course in Miracles. This is chapter 2, with the title heading Fear and Conflict. Being afraid seems to be involuntary, something beyond your own control. Yet I have said already that only constructive acts should be involuntary. My control can take over everything that does not matter, while my guidance can direct everything that does, if you so choose. Fear cannot be controlled by me, but it can be self-controlled. Fear prevents me from giving you my control. The presence of fear shows that you have raised body thoughts to the level of the mind. This removes them from my control and makes you feel personally responsible for them. This is an obvious confusion of levels. I do not foster level confusion, but you must choose to correct it. You would not excuse insane behavior on your part by saying you could not help it. Why should you condone insane thinking? There is a confusion here that you would do well to look at clearly. You may believe that you are responsible for what you do, but not for what you think. The truth is that you are responsible for what you think, because it is only at this level that you can exercise choice. What you do comes from what you think. You cannot separate yourself from the truth by giving autonomy to behavior. This is controlled by me automatically as soon as you place what you think under my guidance. Whenever you are afraid, it is a sure sign that you have allowed your mind to miscreate and have not allowed me to guide it. It is pointless to believe that controlling the outcome of misthought can result in healing. When you are fearful, you have chosen wrongly. That is why you feel responsible for it. You must change your mind, not your behavior, and this is a matter of willingness. You do not need guidance except at the mind level. Correction belongs only at the level where change is possible. Change does not mean anything at the symptom level, where it cannot work. The correction of fear is your responsibility. When you ask for release from fear, you are implying that it is not. You should ask instead for help in the conditions that have brought the fear about. These conditions always entail a willingness to be separate. At that level, you can help it. You are much too tolerant of mind wandering and are passively condoning your mind's miscreations. The particular result does not matter, but the fundamental error does. The correction is always the same. Before you choose to do anything, ask me if your choice is in accord with mine. If you are sure that it is, there will be no fear. Fear is always a sign of strain, arising whenever what you want conflicts with what you do. This situation arises in two ways. First, you can choose to do conflicting things, either simultaneously or successively. This produces conflicted behavior, which is intolerable to you, because the part of the mind that wants to do something else is outraged. Second, you can behave as you think you should, but without entirely wanting to do so. This produces consistent behavior, but entails great strain. In both cases, the mind and the behavior are out of accord, resulting in a situation in which you are doing what you do not wholly want to do. This arouses a sense of coercion that usually produces rage, and projection is likely to follow. Wherever there is fear, it is because you have not made up your mind. Your mind is therefore split, and your behavior inevitably becomes erratic. Correcting at the behavioral level can shift the error from the first to the second type, but will not obliterate the fear. It is possible to reach a state in which you bring your mind under my guidance without conscious effort, but this implies a willingness that you have not developed as yet. The Holy Spirit cannot ask more than you are willing to do. The strength to do comes from your undivided decision. There is no strain in doing God's will as soon as you recognize that it is also your own. The lesson here is quite simple, but particularly likely to be overlooked. I will therefore repeat it, urging you to listen. Only your mind can produce fear. It does so whenever it is conflicted in what it wants, producing inevitable strain, because wanting and doing are discordant. This can be corrected only by accepting a unified goal. The first corrective step in undoing the error is to know first that the conflict is an expression of fear. Say to yourself that you must somehow have chosen not to love, or the fear could not have arisen. Then the whole process of correction becomes nothing more than a series of pragmatic steps in the larger process of accepting the atonement as the remedy. These steps may be summarized in this way. Number 1. Know first that this is fear. 2. Fear arises from lack of love. 3. The only remedy for lack of love is perfect love. 4. Perfect love is the atonement. I have emphasized that the miracle, or the expression of atonement, is always a sign of respect from the worthy to the worthy. The recognition of this worth is re-established by the atonement. It is obvious, then, that when you are afraid, you have placed yourself in a position where you need atonement. You have done something loveless, having chosen without love. This is precisely the situation for which the atonement was offered. The need for the remedy inspired its establishment. As long as you recognize only the need for the remedy, you will remain fearful. However, as soon as you accept the remedy, you have established the fear. This is how true healing occurs. Everyone experiences fear. Yet, it would take very little right thinking to realize why fear occurs. Few appreciate the real power of the mind, and no one remains fully aware of it all the time. However, if you hope to spare yourself from fear, there are some things you must realize, and realize fully. The mind is very powerful and never loses its creative force. It never sleeps. Every instant it is creating. It is hard to recognize that thought and belief combine into a power surge that can literally move mountains. It appears at first glance that to believe such power about yourself is arrogant, but that is not the real reason you do not believe it. You prefer to believe that your thoughts cannot exert real influence because you are actually afraid of them. This may allay awareness of the guilt, but at the cost of perceiving the mind as impotent. If you believe that what you think is ineffectual, you may cease to be afraid of it, but you are hardly likely to respect it. There are no idle thoughts. All thinking produces form at some level.
Will I ever learn then there'll be no peace that the world won't cease until he returns. Surrender your crown on this bloodstained ground. Take her off, you mad. He sees your deeds, he knows your needs, even before you ask. You falsify and deny what is real. How long can you hate yourself for the weakness you conceal? Of every earthly plan that be known to man, he is unconcerned. He's got plans of his own to set up his throne when he returns.
Cause and effect. You may still complain about fear, but you nevertheless persist in making yourself fearful. I have already indicated that you cannot ask me to release you from fear. I know it does not exist, but you do not. If I intervened between your thoughts and their results, I would be tampering with the basic law of cause and effect, the most fundamental law there is. I would hardly help you if I depreciated the power of your own thinking. This would be in direct opposition to the purpose of this course. It is much more helpful to remind you that you do not guard your thoughts carefully enough. You may feel that at this point it would take a miracle to enable you to do this, which is perfectly true. You are not used to miracle-minded thinking, but you can be trained to think that way. All miracle workers need that kind of training. I cannot let you leave your mind unguarded, or you will not be able to help me. Miracle working entails a full realization of the power of thought in order to avoid miscreation. Otherwise, a miracle will be necessary to set the mind itself straight, a circular process that would not foster the time collapse for which the miracle was intended. The miracle worker must have a genuine respect for true cause and effect as a necessary condition for the miracle to occur. Both miracles and fear come from thoughts. If you are not free to choose one, you would also not be free to choose the other. By choosing the miracle, you have rejected fear, if only temporarily. You have been fearful of everyone and everything. You are afraid of God, of me, and of yourself. You have misperceived or miscreated us and believe in what you have made. You would not have done this if you were not afraid of your own thoughts. The fearful must miscreate because they misperceive creation. When you miscreate, you are in pain. The cause and effect principle now becomes a real expediter, though only temporarily. Actually, cause is a term properly belonging to God, and his effect is his son. This entails a set of cause and effect relationships totally different from those you introduce into miscreation. The fundamental conflict in this world, then, is between creation and miscreation. All fear is implicit in the second, and all love in the first. The conflict is therefore one between love and fear. It has already been said that you believe you cannot control fear because you yourself made it, and your belief in it seems to render it out of your control. Yet any attempt to resolve the error through attempting the mastery of fear is useless. In fact, it asserts the power of fear by the very assumption that it need be mastered. The true resolution rests entirely on mastery through love. In the interim, however, the sense of conflict is inevitable, since you have placed yourself in a position where you believe in the power of what does not exist. Nothing and everything cannot coexist. To believe in one is to deny the other. Fear is really nothing, and love is everything. Whenever light enters darkness, the darkness is abolished. What you believe is true for you. In this sense, the separation has occurred, and to deny it is merely to use denial inappropriately. However, to concentrate on error is only a further error. The initial corrective procedure is to recognize temporarily that there is a problem, but only as an indication that immediate correction is needed. This establishes a state of mind in which the atonement can be accepted without delay. It should be emphasized, however, that ultimately no compromise is possible between everything and nothing. Time is essentially a device by which all compromise in this respect can be given up. It only seems to be abolished by degrees, because time itself involves intervals that do not exist. Miscreation made this necessary as a corrective device. The statement, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but should have everlasting life," needs only one slight correction to be meaningful in this context. He gave it to his only begotten Son. It should especially be noted that God has only one Son. If all of his creations are his sons, everyone must be an integral part of the whole sonship. The sonship, in its oneness, transcends the sum of its parts. However, this is obscured as long as any of its parts is missing. That is why the conflict cannot ultimately be resolved until all the parts of the sonship have returned. Only then can the meaning of wholeness in the true sense be understood. Any part of the sonship can believe in error or incompleteness if he so chooses. However, if he does so, he is believing in the existence of nothingness. The correction of this error is the atonement. I have already briefly spoken about readiness, but some additional points might be helpful here. Readiness is only the prerequisite for accomplishment. The two should not be confused. As soon as a state of readiness occurs, there is usually some degree of desire to accomplish, but it is by no means necessarily undivided. The state does not imply more than a potential for a change of mind. Confidence cannot develop fully until mastery has been accomplished. We have already attempted to correct the fundamental error that fear can be mastered, and have emphasized that the only real mastery is through love. Readiness is only the beginning of confidence. You may think this implies that an enormous amount of time is necessary between readiness and mastery, but let me remind you that time and space are under my control.
Captain Cat, the retired blind sea captain, asleep in his bunk in the sea-shelled ship-in-bottle ship-shape best cabin of schooner house, dreams of never such seas as any that swamped the decks of his SS Kidwelly, bellying over the bedclothes, and jellyfish slippery sucking him down salt-deep into the Davy dark, where the fish come biting out and nibble him down to his wishbone, and the long-drowned nuzzle up to him.
Remember me, Captain?
You're dancing, Williams.
I lost my step in Nantucket.
Do you see me, Captain? The white-born talking. I'm Tom Fred, the donkey man. We shared the same girl once. Her name was Mrs. Probert.
Rosie Probert, 33 Duck Lane, Come on up, boys. I'm dead.
Hold me, Captain. I'm Jonah Jarvis. Come to a bad end. Very enjoyable.
Alfred Pomeroy Jones, sea lawyer, born in Mumbles, sung like a linnet, crowned you with a flagon, tattooed with mermaids, thirst like a dredger, died of blisters.
This skull at your ear all is...
Curly Bevan! Tell my auntie it was me that pawned the Ormolu clock.
Aye, aye, Curly.
Tell my missus, no, I never. I never done what she said, I never.
Yes, they did.
And who brings coconuts and shawls and parrots to my Gwen now?
How's it above?
Is there rum and lava bread?
Bosoms and robins?
Concertinas?
Ebenezer's bell?
Fighting and onions?
And sparrows and daisies?
Tiddlers in a jam jar?
Buttermilk and whippets?
Rockabye baby?
Washing on the line?
And old girls in the snug?
How's the tenors in Dowlice?
Who milks the cows in my Squin?
When she smiles, is there dimples?
What's the smell of parsley?
Oh, my dead dears.
From where you are, you can hear in Cockle Row in the spring, moonless night, Miss Price, dressmaker and sweet shopkeeper, dream of her lover, tall as the town clock tower, Samson syrup gold-maned, whacking-thighed and piping hot, thunderbolt-based and barnacle-breasted, flailing up the cockles with his eyes like blow-lamps and scooping low over her lonely, loving, hot water-bottle body.
Mavanui Price.
Mr. Mark Edwards.
I am a draper, mad with love. I love you more than all the flannelet and calico, candlewick, dimity, crush and merino, tussor, cretonne, crepon, muslin, poplin, ticking and twill in the whole cloth hall of the world. I have come to take you away to my emporium on the hill where the change hums on wires. Throw away your little bed socks and your Welsh wool knitted jacket. I will warm the sheets like an electric toaster. I will lie by your side like the Sunday roast.
I will knit you a wallet of forget-me-not blue for the money to be comfy. I will warm your heart by the fire so that you can slip it under your vest when the shop is closed.
Mavanui, Mavanui, before the mice gnaw at your bottom drawer. Will you say?
Yes, Mog, yes, Mog, yes, yes, yes.
And all the bells of the tills of the town shall ring for our wedding.
Come now, drift up the dark. Come up the drifting sea-dark street now, in the dark night sea-sawing like the sea, to the Bible-black, airless attic over Jack Black the cobbler's shop, where alone and savagely Jack Black sleeps in a nightshirt tied to his ankles with elastic and dreams of chasing the naughty couples on the grass-green, gooseberry double bed of the wood, flogging the tosspots in the spit and sawdust, driving out the bare, bold girls from the sixpenny hops of his nightmares.
Achavi! Achavi!
Evans the Death, the undertaker, laughs high and aloud in his sleep and curls up his toes as he sees, upon waking 50 years ago, snow lie deep on the goose field behind the sleeping house. And he runs out into the field where his mother is making Welsh cakes in the snow and steals a fistful of snowflakes and currants and climbs back to bed to eat them cold and sweet under the warm white clothes while his mother dances in the snow kitchen, crying out for her lost currants. And in the little pink-eyed cottage next to the undertaker's lie alone the 17 snoring, gentle stone of Mr. Waldo, rabbit catcher, barber, herbalist, cat doctor, quack, his fat pink hands palms up over the edge of the patchwork quilt, his black boots neat and tidy in the washing basin, his bowler on a nail above the bed, a milk stout and a slice of cold bread pudding under the pillow. And, dripping in the dark, he dreams of...
This little piggy went to market. This little piggy stayed at home. This little piggy had roast beef. This little piggy had none, and this little piggy went...
Wee, 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 wee.
All the way home to...
Waldo! Waldo!
Yes, Blodwen, love?
Oh, what'll the neighbours say? What'll the neighbours?
Poor Mrs. Waldo.
What she puts up with.
Never should have married.
If she didn't have to.
Same as her mother.
There's a husband for you.
Bad as his father.
And you know where he ended.
Up in the asylum.
Crying for his ma.
Every Saturday.
He hasn't got a leg.
And carrying on.
With that Mrs. Beattie Morris.
Up in the quarry.
And seen her baby.
It's got his nose.
Oh, it makes my heart bleed.
What he'll do for drink.
He sold the pianola.
And her sewing machine.
Falling in the gutter.
Talking to the lamppost.
Using language.
Singing in the W.
Poor Mrs. Waldo.
Oh, Waldo. Waldo.
Hush, love, hush. I'm widower, Waldo, now.
Waldo? Waldo?
Yes, our mum?
Oh, what'll the neighbours say? What'll the neighbours?
Black as a chimbley.
Ringing doorbells.
Breaking windows.
Making mud pies.
Stealing currants.
Talking words.
Saw him in the bushes.
Playing mouchins.
Send him to bed without any supper.
Give him senna pod and lock him in the dark.
Off to the reformatory.
Off to the reformatory.
Learn him with a slipper on his BTM.
Waldo? Waldo? What you doing with our Marty?
Give us a kiss, Marty Richard.
Give us a penny, then.
I only got a penny.
Lip. Is a penny.
Will you take this woman, Matty Richards?
Dulcie Prothero.
Effie Bevan.
Lil the glue pot.
Mrs. Flusher.
Blodwyn Bowen.
To be your awful wedded wife.
No! No! No!
Now, in her iceberg white, holily laundered crinoline nightgown and her virtuous polar sheets, in her spruced and scoured, dust-defying bedroom in Trig and Trim Bayview, a house for paying guests at the top of the town, Mrs. Ogmore Pritchard, widow twice of Mr. Ogmore, linoleum, retired, and Mr. Pritchard, failed bookmaker, who, maddened by bezooming, swabbing and scrubbing, the voice of the vacuum cleaner and the fume of polish, ironically swallowed disinfectant, fidgets in her rinsed sleep, wakes in a dream, and nudges in the ribs. Dead, Mr. Ogmore. Dead, Mr. Pritchard. Ghostly on either side.
Mr. Ogmore, Mr. Pritchard, it is time to inhale your balsam.
Oh, Mrs. Ogmore. Oh, Mrs. Pritchard.
Soon it will be time to get up. Tell me your tasks. In order.
I must put my pyjamas in the drawer marked pyjamas. I must take my cold bath, which is good for me. I must wear my flannel band to ward off sciatica. I must dress behind the curtain and put on my apron. I must blow my nose.
In the garden, if you please.
In a piece of tissue paper, which I afterwards burn.
I must take my salts, which are nature's friend.
I must boil the drinking water because of germs.
I must make my herb tea, which is free from tannin.
And have a charcoal biscuit, which is good for me.
I may smoke one pipe of asthma mixture.
In the woodshed, if you please.
And dust the parlour and spray the canary.
I must put on rubber gloves and search the peak for fleas.
I must dust the blinds and then I must raise them.
And before you let the sun in, mind it wipes its shoes.
In Butcher Bynum's, Gossamer Bynum, daughter, schoolteacher, dreaming deep, daintily ferrets under a fluttering hummock of chicken's feathers in a slaughterhouse that has chintz curtains and a three-piece suite, and finds, with no surprise, a small, rough, ready man with a bushy tail winking in a paper carrier.
At last, my love,
sighs Gossamer Bynum, and the bushy tail wags rude and ginger. Cries Organ Morgan, the organist, in his dreams.
There is perturbation and music in Coronation Street. All the spouses are honking like geese, and the baby's singing opera. P.C. Attila Rees has got his truncheon out and is playing cadenzas by the pump. The cows from Sunday Meadow ring like reindeer. And on the roof of Handel Villa, see the women's welfare hoofing bloomered in the moon.
At the sea end of town, Mr. and Mrs. Floyd, the Cocklers, are sleeping as quiet as death, side by wrinkled side, toothless, salt and brown, like two old kippers in a box. And high above, in Salt Lake Farm, Mr. Uta Watkins counts all night the white-faced sheep as they leap the fences on the hill, smiling and knitting and bleating, just like Mrs. Uta Watkins.
34, 35, 36, 48, 89.
Knit one, slip one, knit two together, pass the slip stitch over.
Hockey Milkman, drowned asleep in Cockle Street, is emptying his churns into the Dewey River.
The gardens of expense.
And weeping like a funeral. Cherry Owen next door lifts a tankard to his lips, but nothing flows out of it. He shakes the tankard. It turns into a fish. He drinks the fish. P.C. Artillerese lumps out of bed, dead to the dark and still foghorning, and drags out his helmet from under the bed. But deep in the backyard lockup of his sleep, a mean voice murmurs,
"You'll be sorry for this in the morning."
And he heave-hoes back to bed. His helmet swashes in the dark. Willy-nilly postman, asleep upstreet, walks 14 miles to deliver the post, as he does every day of the night, and rat-a-tats hard and sharp on Mrs. Willy-nilly.
"Don't spank me, please, teacher,"
whimpers his wife at his side. But every night of her married life, she has been late for school. Sinbad Sailors, over the taproom of the Sailor's Arms, hugs his damp pillow, whose secret name is
Cosima Boynan.
A mogul catches Lily Smalls in the washhouse.
Oh, you old mogul!
Mrs. Rose Cottage's eldest, May, peels off her pink and white skin in a furnace, in a tower, in a cave, in a waterfall, in a wood, and waits there, raw as an onion, for Mr. Wright to leap up the burning, tall, hollow splashes of leaves like a brilliantine trout.
"Call me Dolores, like they do in the stories."
Alone until she dies, Bessie Bighead, hired help, born in the workhouse, smelling of the cowshed, snores bass and gruff on a couch of straw in a loft in Salt Lake Farm, and picks a posy of daisies in Sunday Meadow to put on the grave of Gomer Owen, who kissed her once by the pigsty when she wasn't looking, and never kissed her again, although she was looking all the time. And the inspectors of cruelty fly down into Mrs. Butcher Bynan's dream to persecute Mr. Bynan for selling
owl meat, dog's eyes, man chop.
Mr. Bynan, in butcher's bloodied apron, spring heels down Coronation Street, a finger not his own in his mouth. Straight-faced, in his cunning sleep, he pulls the legs of his dreams and
hunting on pigback, shoots down the wild giblets.
Help!
My foxy darling.
Now, behind the eyes and secrets of the dreamers in the streets rocked asleep by the sea, see the titbits and topsy-turvies, bobs and button-tops, bags and bones, ash and rind and dandruff and nail-parings, saliva and snowflakes and molted feathers of dreams, the wrecks and sprats and shells and fish-bones, whale juice and moonshine, and small salt-fry dished up by the hidden sea. The owls are hunting. Look, over Bethesda gravestones, one hoots and swoops and catches a mouse by Hannah Reese, beloved wife. And in Coronation Street, which you alone can see, it is so dark under the chapel in the skies, the Reverend Eli Jenkins, poet, preacher, turns in his deep towards dawn sleep and dreams of
Eistedd vor dau.
He intricately rhymes to the music of Cruth and Pibgorn all night long in his druid seedy nighty in a beer tent black with parchs. Mr. Pugh, schoolmaster, fathoms asleep, pretends to be sleeping, spies Foxy round the droop of his nightcap and
psst,
whistles up,
"Murder."
Mrs. Organ Morgan, groceress, coiled grey like a dormouse, her paws to her ears, conjures
silence.
She sleeps very dulcet in a cove of wool, and trumpeting Organ Morgan at her side snores no louder than a spider. Mary Ann Sailor's dreams of
the Garden of Eden.
She comes in her smock frock and clogs.
Away from the cool, scrubbed, cobbled kitchen, with the Sunday school pictures on the whitewashed wall, and the farmer's almanac hung above the settle, on the sides of bacon on the ceiling hooks, and goes down the cockle-shelled paths of that apple pie kitchen garden, ducking under the gippo's claws pegs, catching her apron on the blackcurrant bushes, past bean rows and onion bed and tomatoes ripening on the wall, toward the old man playing the harmonium in the orchard, and sits down on the grass at his side and shells the green peas that grow up through the lap of her frock that brushes the dew.
In Donkey Street, so furred with sleep, Dye Bread, Polly Garter, No Good Boyle, and Lord Cut Glass sigh before the dawn that is about to be and dream of
harems, babies,
nothing.
Tick-tock, 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 tick-tock.
Time passes. Listen. Time passes. An owl flies home past Bethesda to a chapel in an oak. And the dawn inches up.
If you want to be a great leader, you must learn to follow the Tao. Stop trying to control. Let go of fixed plans and concepts, and the world will govern itself. The more prohibitions you have, the less virtuous people will be. The more weapons you have, the less secure people will be. The more subsidies you have, the less self-reliant people will be. Therefore, the master says, I let go of the law, and people become honest. I let go of economics, and people become prosperous. I let go of religion, and people become serene. I let go of all desire of the common good, and the good becomes common as grass. Thank you for joining me today. Any questions, comments, judgments, you can send me an email at gracenoteswgxz@gmail.com.